Seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'll be serving as the session moderator, coming to you from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. In just a moment, we'll be joined by a number of speakers, also coming to you from EPA, as part of the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Again, we'll be joined by Ann Daly, Kate Garufi, and Dave Bartenfelder, who will be helping to provide an overview of new EPA Superfund groundwater guidance and tools. The EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response and their Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation help sponsor today's session. Before we begin the technical portion of today's broadcast, I'm going to walk through a few basic reminders and housekeeping items for today's seminar. For those of you that may be new to the webinar, and if you're not sure what to do, you should have a reminder email in your inbox that has a complete set of instructions on how to join us for the live broadcast. That email will basically point you to something known as the seminar homepage. On that homepage, you can read more about the broadcast. You'll find contact information for the presenters. There are links to download copies of the slides. There's even an online form you can use to share feedback for today's webinar after the live broadcast. For now, though, you want to click a button that appears in the upper left corner of that page labeled Go to Seminar. Once you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself by name, as well as the number of people at your location, and you should be successfully checked in online to our Adobe Connect environment that we'll be using for today's live broadcast. If you have any problems checking in online or joining us through Adobe, you can simply download a copy of the slides and follow along on the phone. But you might miss out on some of the interactive features, so we encourage you to let us know if you're having problems so we can troubleshoot them and get you on board. Audio by default will be available online through Adobe Connect. That means everyone can actually listen to this talk right through their computer with a pair of speakers or headphones. If the online audio isn't working, make sure that it's turned on. You should see a green speaker icon near the top of your screen. If it's not shaded green, click it or click that triangle to pop up a menu to allow you to connect to the online audio. If that still doesn't solve the problem, check your local volume settings. Sometimes people have to increase their speaker output in the sound control panel to get it loud enough. Of course, if that does not work, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. Just use the Q&A window to request that number. I'll be more than happy to share that with you. If you join us, though, on the phone lines, all callers will be placed on a global mute, and we ask that you remain on that global mute to minimize background noise and other audio disruptions. Q&A. We will be accepting questions and comments throughout today's live broadcast using a small window labeled Q&A that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. You should already see a welcome message from me, Jean, in that window, and you can use that window again to privately enter your questions, comments, as well as to report technical problems at any time. You can feel free to test that window out right now if you like. You feel free to say hello or just let us know how the audio and visuals are working for you. We will have a designated break for Q&A, and at that time, I will be reading through some of the questions and some of the questions to give our presenters time to answer them. But we do have a very large audience and a limited amount of time today, so I highly encourage participants to submit comments and questions as soon as they occur to you so that we can basically get in as many questions as we can in the time that we have allotted today. Today's session is being recorded and will automatically be archived on the CLUIN website. It usually takes us approximately 1 to 2 weeks to produce these recordings, and all registered participants will receive the email as soon as that archive is available for free replay and download. And if you're interested in learning more about what we do, we have nearly 600 previously recorded webinars available for free replay and download. So just a few quick reminders. You should see a screen something like this. On the left side, we'll show our PowerPoint slides. If you have any problems viewing the slides, there's a button that appears in the upper right that looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. If you click that four-arrow button once, it'll make the slides larger. If you click it a second time, it'll shrink the slides back down. And you can feel free to expand the size of the slides as needed for your improved viewing experience. Along the right-hand side, you'll see EPA's logo in the upper right corner. We have a collection of related URLs. Those are all active hyperlinks. You can click on any one of the links and then press the Browse To button to open up those websites locally. So again, if you're looking for copies of the slides, you'll find those online from the seminar homepage. And then lastly, that Q&A window appears in the lower right corner of your screen. You can click your mouse cursor on the empty box at the very bottom of the Q&A window, type up your question or comment here, and either hit the Enter key or press that cartoon bubble button to the right, and that will privately submit your comment or question in. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I had for today's session. So again, with that reminder, we will be taking a few breaks for Q&A, so please enter in those questions and comments as soon as they occur to you. Another gentle reminder, please stay on the global mute if you're on the phone line. And I think with that, I'll be ready to turn things over to one of your first presenters today, Ann Daly. Ann, whenever you're ready, please begin.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Jean. And hello, everybody. Thanks for participating in the webinar today. Today is the first webinar in a series of two webinars that we'll be giving in November. The second webinar will be next week, and will be about evaluating completion of groundwater restoration remedial actions. It'll be on Wednesday, November 12th, so I encourage folks to sign up for that one as well. So my name is Ann Daly, and I'm an environmental scientist with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. And I've been in this office for a couple of years. I was previously in Region 10 for more than 20 years in both the Superfund and water programs. And I'm presenting the slides today with my co-authors, Kate Garufi and Dave Bartenfelder are here as well. We also had, I guess I just say up front as well, that we had a lot of involvement from the Groundwater Forum and the regional offices as we put all of these groundwater guidance and tools together. I'll just acknowledge all those folks that participated in putting these things together. So as Jean mentioned, given the number of participants, we'll have two spots where we'll stop and take questions during the talk. And then there'll also be a Q&A discussion at the end of the talk as well. So please go ahead and use the Q&A pod as Jean suggested. Let's see. Okay. Here we go. Okay. So the talk today will cover or provide some background and context for this new suite of guidance, basically why EPA decided it was worth putting resources into putting together these new guidance documents. Provide an overview of the new guidance documents with a deeper focus on one of them, the remedy completion strategy, and some discussion about technical and practicability waivers, and provide some contacts and information sources for additional investigating that you may want to do later, and also touch on the next webinar that will be happening next week. Okay, I think as we all know, the groundwater is a precious and limited resource, and given the importance of groundwater to society and the environment, remediation of contaminated groundwater is a really critical element of federal, state, and tribal cleanup programs. Protection of water, including groundwater, is one of EPA Administrator's top seven priorities. And collectively, federal agencies, states, PRPs, and others spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year to address groundwater contamination. And EPA alone spends on the order of $30 to $50 million a year on the operation of fund lead groundwater restoration actions during the first 10 years of implementation. So lots of resources from lots of different parties go into groundwater sites. In the 2013 Superfund Remedy Review Report that EPA issued last November, there is an analysis looking at Superfund sites and learned that nearly 90% of the current Superfund National Priority List sites have a component of a groundwater remedy. And that may include like an active remedy like pump and treat, could be in situ, could be natural attenuation. So there's a lot of groundwater sites in the universe of NPL sites. A lot of money, a lot of sites. And it's described in EPA's 2009 memo looking at EPA CERCLA policies, there's five key cleanup expectations at groundwater sites. The first of those is to restore groundwater to beneficial use wherever practicable. And the second is to define and contain the plume to stop the contaminant migration. The third clear expectation is that early actions should be taken as soon as possible to address the source or sources of contamination. And then fourthly, that institutional controls are often a component of remedies, but they should not be the only response at groundwater remedies. And institutional control may be such thing as provision of unalternate water supply to residences. And then finally, if restoration is not technically practicable, it may be appropriate to consider a technical and practicability waiver. Again, we'll talk more about that towards the end of the talk as well. Okay, So, you know, groundwater contamination is a key challenge at a lot of Superfund sites, but it's important to realize that EPA and our partners really are making tangible progress at a lot of sites, and that the cause is not all lost. An upcoming EPA report will provide more details on some groundwater sites where they're actually making good progress at achieving their remedial action objectives, and even where RAOs have not been achieved, significant progress, typically on the order of multiple orders of magnitude, in reduction of contaminants has been achieved. And a lot of these sites that have found success have used, you know, multiple cleanup technologies, including source control, as well as multiple remedial techniques, as well as optimization strategies throughout implementation of the remedy. So there's a few trends that we've seen in groundwater cleanup sites. And one's a decrease in the number of sites selecting pump and treat over time. And in parallel, there's been an increase in sites selecting in-situ treatment since the 1990s. And more than a third of groundwater sites typically use multiple cleanup technologies and also often phase those remedial technologies throughout the cleanup process to achieve the remedial action objectives. As well, in-situ treatment and monitored natural attenuation are often used together at cleanups. And as mentioned earlier, a lot of remedies are including institutional controls such as water supply or other engineering controls to provide safe water for folks. And just quickly, this is a graphic out of the Superfund Remedy Report just illustrating the reduction in the decrease in use of pump and treat, and parallel slight increase in use of in-situ. The blue line is the pump and treat decrease over time. Okay, so while we're making progress at groundwater sites, there do remain a lot of challenges. And a few of these challenges include just issues with the settings in terms of complex hydrogeologic situations, fractured bedrock, subsurface groundwater interactions that may make it complex to clean up a site. There may be matrix diffusion issues. There may be DNAPL sources that provide an ongoing source of contamination. There can also be climate change impacts, for example, extreme drought, extreme flooding, changes in groundwater levels, and saltwater intrusion that can make a clean groundwater cleanup more complex. Furthermore, at some sites, there may not be an accurate or complete conceptual site model. Without that really good understanding of what's going on at a site, it's hard to make good tangible project progress. In addition, it's costly to build and operate groundwater remedy systems, and they often need to operate for a long time. So getting back to that issue of a lot of resources going to groundwater sites. Okay, furthermore, some older cleanup plans or records of decisions may not have clearly defined remedial action objectives. And you'll see this is kind of a theme throughout all of this stuff. Without a clear definition of an endpoint or interim milestones, it can be really difficult to define an efficient and effective path to remedy completion because you don't have your goalposts defined. Furthermore, at some groundwater remedies, they may have reached technical limitations with the treatment system, and without a focused review, then opportunities for improvement and getting the remedy back on track might be overlooked. And at some sites, there can be a lack of consensus or understanding among the site team and or stakeholders that can prove difficult. If you don't have the site team having the same view on how a remedy is performing and progressing, or the information needed, or the appropriate steps to achieve remedy completions, it's hard, sometimes hard to move forward on cleanups. Also, EPA headquarters does a review of site deletion packages, and through this effort, we found that several issues that have been kind of a theme with some deletion packages where, again, there may not be clear groundwater remedial action objectives, as just mentioned earlier, in the decision document. That could pose challenges when you get to the point of deleting a site from the national priorities list. In addition, at some sites, we've seen groundwater monitoring may have been discontinued, and even monitoring wells pulled or removed from the ground before data supporting attainment of the groundwater cleanup level is collected. So if you don't have that documentation, it's hard to delete the site. In addition, we've seen issues related to data, for like, for example, intra and interwell averaging of data. There's also been issues with, again, the data not supporting a completion determination for the groundwater aquifer media. Okay, and then in 2011, EPA issued the groundwater roadmap. Kate Garufi, who's been involved in all this, was the lead author on development of that groundwater roadmap. And the roadmap essentially provides a recommended process for restoring groundwater and compiles highlights of relevant Superfund law, regulations, policy, and guidance related to groundwater. And we noticed through development of this roadmap that two areas were identified as needing additional guidance. So they're kind of highlighted in the circles, which I realize are hard to read. But what those say is basically that the top circle is evaluate whether the existing remedy can achieve RAOs and associated cleanup levels on the rod. And the second one is have those RAOs and cleanup levels been achieved? So it's just, are you making progress, and it hasn't been achieved? So I'd say the community would benefit from additional guidance on those two topics. So just in summary with this piece here is that with this background and guidance in a context, hopefully you can appreciate the importance and challenges associated with groundwater cleanups and why EPA decided to put resources in developing a new suite of groundwater guidance. And the approach that we've put together in the guidance is that we'll talk more about builds on the experiences that EPA and the remediation community to date and reflects increasing knowledge about groundwater remediation. So the suite of guidance is intended to help focus resources on making smart site decisions to move sites forward to get them completed, and also intended to provide or identify criteria for assessing groundwater remedy progress and attainment of remedial action objectives and cleanup levels, and help address these policy gaps that I just mentioned related to implementation and completion of groundwater restoration actions, and also to help address some issues that have been identified during review of MPL's deletion packages. And finally, just to help provide a more robust scientific and defensible basis for making smart cleanup decisions. Okay, so here's a list of the guidance we'll go through. And again, I'd just like to note that these documents are all developed in collaboration with EPA's Groundwater Forum and EPA regional offices, and they're all available on the webpage, and there's a link at the end of the document where you can get these, as well as we provided a link within the webinar structure that Gene provided. So there's lots of places you can get a hold of this stuff. And also, I guess, mention as well that these were prepared with our EPA Headquarters Office of Federal Facilities and Restoration and Reuse Office. So the federal facilities folks were involved in putting all this together as well. Okay. So the first one of these is that we're going to talk about here is the Groundwater Remedy Completion Strategy. It was issued in May 2014. And this was identified as a logical next step from the groundwater roadmap issued in 2011. And again, this guidance was co-developed with the other guidances that we'll talk about. They were issued separately, but all developed together. So this document, again, reflects considerable input from the Groundwater Forum, the EPA regional offices, and also received input during a public review process and a tribal consultation period. So this guidance essentially recommends a common sense approach for stepwise planning and a decision-making process for evaluating site-specific Superfund groundwater remedy performance, operation, and attainment of remedial action objectives and cleanup levels. So the recommended approach is intended to help focus resources towards the effective and efficient completion of groundwater remedies. The strategy essentially uses the data quality objective or DQO process, as a lot of folks are probably familiar with that process, of thinking ahead to decisions that need to be made, and then ensuring as you go through implementation of a project or site remedial action that the monitoring data collected is focused on the data that's needed to make decisions. A lot of times folks may end up with, at the end of the day, trying to make decisions or realize they don't have data at the right frequency or the right depth intervals or the right detection limit or whatnot, and then you kind of get yourself in a pickle. So the intent is to help think ahead to what decisions you need to make and then back up to make sure you're gathering that right, that proper data all the way along. So the strategy also encourages reevaluation of remedies and remedial decisions if the site is not making timely progress through the achievement of the remedial action objectives and cleanup levels. The strategy also promotes stakeholder consensus by use of a flexible structure for development of transparent and site-specific strategies. The strategies hopefully will help get site teams kind of all on the same page regarding understanding of what's going on at their site. Okay, the groundwater completion strategy has essentially five main elements. And the first of these is to make sure you have a current understanding of the site conditions. This is a really key component, and it's understood that this will evolve as the remedy progresses and also as the site conditions may change, perhaps even independent of the remedy. So you need to, that CSM that was put together in 1990 may not still be accurate. It's important to have a current conceptual site model. The second element of the remedy completion strategy is design of site-specific remedy evaluations that would typically focus, again, on remedy operation, progress of the remedy, and ultimately attainment of the remedial action objectives and cleanup levels. Examples of remedy evaluation questions that would be site-specific, but they may be such as, like, are the treatment units functioning as intended? Are concentrations of the contaminants of concern identified in the rod decreasing as expected? Is the plume shrinking as expected? You come up with these site-specific evaluation questions. And then the third element is that once you have those remedy evaluation questions defined and in hand, the next step is to define performance metrics that will inform the site-specific remedy evaluations. And I'll have in the next slide, we'll talk a little bit about performance metrics because that's a pretty important piece of this. And then the fourth component is when you're collecting, you then to collect data, looking at your you use monitoring data collected on the performance metrics, and then remedy evaluations are done to assess the remedy operation progress and attainment of the evaluation of the remedy specific evaluations, looking at ultimately focus of achievement of the REOs and cleanup levels. So the outcome of the remedy evaluations should then be used to make smart site decisions regarding the remedy and any changes that you might find are appropriate to make to ensure reasonable progress of the cleanup. So as part of this, you know, remedy optimization or alternate response approaches may be appropriate if performance indicates that the selected remedy may not be able to achieve the groundwater remedial actions or cleanup levels in a reasonable time frame. And depending on the significance of any of those changes you might need to make, it may be that a record of decision amendment or explanation of significant differences might be needed. Okay, so what's the performance metrics? Performance metrics are an important piece of this thing, and they're essentially site-specific, they're quantitative performance measurements that help support the site evaluations and decision making. So they're customized for a specific site and should be helped to help generate information that can be used to answer those site-specific remedy evaluations discussed earlier. So again, performance metrics are site-specific, and they may include such things as effluent discharge concentrations. Perhaps if you have a discharge at your site, they may include diagnostic parameters, hydrogeologic parameters like oxygen levels, could include contaminant concentration trends in a monitoring well and so forth. So you can kind of get the sense of where those are going. Okay, this is just a simple graphic that kind of tries to capture the whole vision of a remedy completion strategy. The process of thinking ahead to future site and remedy decisions and helping to ensure that the right questions and data and information are collected all along to support technically and science-based site evaluations and decisions. So this, you know, graphic assumes that you have your current conceptual site model in hand. And then on the left, you define the remedy evaluation questions, thinking about your remedy in hand. And then, so those are the yellow ovals. And then you, once you have your evaluation questions in hand, you think about, well, what kind of metrics would I use to evaluate, for example, is the groundwater extraction rate adequate? And then, well, so for this, a simple example here, you got extraction rate and capture zone. You might want to gather that kind of data to evaluate whether your extraction rate's adequate. And you collect that data, and then you conduct a remedy evaluation and determine whether the remedy operation and progress is adequate, and are you making good progress towards achieving the RAOs? And in fact, depending on where you are, have those been achieved? So the point of all this is thinking ahead towards the making the site decisions and making sure you have the right data collected all the way along and that you're working with the other parties involved and everybody's on the same page, hopefully. So when you get to the point where you have the data to make site decisions, you're in a place where you actually can make those. So early on, there was some misleading press about what the remedy completion strategy does. So we're just trying to emphasize that the recommended framework does not alter the agency approach for setting remedial action objectives or cleanup levels. That process is still the same. That has not changed. It also does not change other existing guidance or policy on remedy selection. It also does not address groundwater classifications or use designations. And it also does not request states or tribes alter their existing groundwater classification or use designations. So the strategy really doesn't direct or prescribe any decisions. Instead, it kind of lays the framework or the foundation for making technically informed site-specific decisions. So this is one of these spots where we thought we'd take a stop for a minute and see if there were any questions we could answer. So, Jean, do you have any questions you'd want to pass on?
Yeah, just a reminder, participants, you can submit your questions and comments in the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. I did have a few questions that came in, and some people wanted to know how can they stay on top of the latest strategies and policies. Are there listservs or other ways that they can receive announcements when you guys release new guidance?
Well, what we do is we put them on the web page, which we've got links to there, and we provide information, you know, in forums like this and through the technical support forums. We try a number of different ways to get the word out on new things that are coming out. Kate and Dave, do you have any other suggestions on that?
We try different mechanisms, but we don't have like a listserv that,
yeah,
that we do a mass emailing that we have a new document. We don't have.
No.
Okay. So that one website is probably the best way to look for the most recent guidance.
Well, I mean, the one listserv that does come out is the Tech Direct thing that gets put together by your office, Gene, and we've always put information in that as well. So that does, I think, I don't know, there's some thousands of number of people that are signed up for that. Maybe we can provide people can get to that through the place they signed up for this talk.
Okay, excellent.
So that is a listserv, but we do make the information available.
Yep, and we had a couple people point out that very same listserv, so it sounds like using TechDirect would also be a appreciated way by the audience if you want to share the word about it.
Yeah, we do that.
I also have another comment that came in, and this one relates back to the strategy that you had just highlighted. They state that the strategy highlights the need to understand current site conditions, and that often can only be done with additional data, sometimes new monitoring points and techniques that can often cost more money. Is EPA planning to support these new guidance and strategies with increased funding for that work?
Well, I mean, any additional work would need to be prioritized within the site funding mechanism. We have identified a little bit of money to try and put together a couple of example remedy completion strategies. But basically, folks would need to work within the structure of their funding for their site generally to come up with this this approach. I mean, the idea is that, you know, it may cost a little money to put this together, but hopefully in the long term, the net outcome, you'll be saving money because you'll be able to identify and hone in on that information that's really needed to make decisions. And there's a site I worked on and for a number of years, and we looked at the monitoring. We were able to cut back the monitoring substantially once we took a fresh look at it with an updated CSM, and we're able to ultimately save quite a bit of resources by taking a fresh look at it.
Okay. I also see one other clarifying question, and this one is actually related to guidance that isn't necessarily EPA guidance. One of the participants is asking about recent ASTM passive sampler guidance. They want to know if EPA was involved in the development of that and if you'll be talking about or providing training on that new standard.
I don't think we can answer that question, Jean.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't see any other questions or comments coming in from the audience. So again, just a reminder, keep the questions and comments coming in through the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. And Anne, feel free to carry on.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jean. Okay, so moving on then, this is moving on to another piece of the guidance in the set of guidance that we've recently come out with. And again, these were the subsequent sets of guidance. These were all developed together. All four of these were developed at the same time, essentially, though they came out separately. So November 2013, EPA issued guidance for evaluating completion of groundwater restoration remedial actions. And the purpose of this guidance document, again available on the webpage, that we mentioned earlier, is to provide guidance for EPA regions on how to determine when a groundwater restoration action is complete, and also to provide clarification on of groundwater attainment expectations that are referenced and mentioned in a number of other existing Superfund and EPA guidance documents. This guidance recommends evaluating contaminant of concern or COC concentration levels on a well-by-well basis in conjunction with, again, a current conceptual site model to help provide the technical foundation to conclude that the groundwater has met and will continue to meet the cleanup levels for all the contaminants of concern defined in the Record of Decision. So cumulatively, this provides information to evaluate whether the aquifer restoration remediation is complete for a site. This guidance does provide criteria for halting monitoring at individual wells while remediation continues elsewhere in the plume. The webinar that we're providing next week on the 12th will provide more information about this guidance as well as the subsequent ones. Okay, then following on the November 2013 groundwater restoration guidance, in August 2014, so just a couple months ago, EPA issued a recommended approach and a companion optional statistical tool to evaluate completion at a specific well. For purposes of this guidance, the groundwater remedy evaluation is divided into two phases, the remediation phase and the attainment phase. The remediation phase refers to that period when remedial activities are being implemented. Maybe I've got a groundwater pump and treat system actually operating. And this phase is typically finished when the cleanup levels for all contaminants of concern have been met at a specific well. So the attainment, and you can see that on the little graph that hopefully you can see on the left side of the dotted vertical line is the remediation phase where you've got several contaminants, you're remediating different cleanup levels, and when you've achieved the at the remediation phase, then you move into the attainment phase, which typically occurs after EPA makes the determination that the remediation phase is complete and also that active remediation has ceased. So, for example, if you had a pump and treat system, you would have turned the pump and treat system off, and the natural steady state would have restored itself within the groundwater. So the purpose of the attainment phase data monitoring is to determine if the cleanup level for each contaminant, again, has been met, and if the groundwater will continue to meet that cleanup level into the future. It's basically to ensure that you don't have rebound for that contaminant into the future. So this guidance also includes information about monitoring well network considerations, such as the importance of adequate characterization of the contaminant aquifer. Also considers reevaluation of the monitoring well network as cleanup proceeds, such as you may need to make adjustments to that network as you move forward. And also tips on consideration of the number of wells and the frequency of sampling. And again, this may change as the remediation progresses and the plume evolves over time. It may evolve to things beyond just the remediation. So basically, at the end of the day, the monitoring well conclusions should demonstrate that the groundwater has met the cleanup levels for all contaminants of concern and that this will be sustainable into the future. Okay, as well in 2014, the optional groundwater statistics tool was issued, and Dave Bartenfelder, who's with us today, was the lead author on the groundwater stats tool. And this was also developed with the Groundwater Forum and others. This follows essentially the logic laid out in the last two documents and the recommended approach for evaluating groundwater restoration actions. The tool uses statistics to help evaluate completion of the groundwater remediation action at a specific well and for a specific contaminant. The groundwater stats tool is not required. It's optional. But it is an option for making a completion determination. The tool was designed to be easily understood and implemented. There are, as folks know, a lot of other statistical tools that may be more robust and have, some of them have greater data input requirements and also somewhat confusing outputs. But the STATS tool is intended to be useful and readily used by folks in an Excel framework and easily downloadable from our webpage. There's guidance on there about how to use it as well. And we will go through on the webinar next week, a demo on use of the STATS. So I'd encourage people to tag in to see how that works. They will do a demo of that. So the data is designed to address normal and non-normal data sets, kind of within reasonable constraints. Super complex groundwater data sets might be better served by a more robust statistical tool, but this will be useful in a lot of situations and is easily run. So I'm going to stop here then see if any questions on the last couple slides here, Jean.
Yeah, we had two questions come in, and the first one is in relation back to five-year reviews. They'd like you to highlight how these guidance tie into the existing guidance covering five-year reviews.
Okay. Well, a five-year review is an evaluation done to determine whether remedy is making good progress or is towards being protective or is still protective. And then depending on where you are within the framework of your remedy, it may be appropriate to have done some of these analyses to support the five-year review, or it may come out as a recommendation as part of the five-year review that it would be appropriate to do some of these evaluations going forward. So it all works together, and there's some work being done on five-year review guidance that will include further discussion of the application of these within the five-year review context. Do you want anything, Kate? Okay.
We do have some additional questions that are coming in, so I'll continue to encourage people to keep typing those up. I'm going to carry on with some of these questions. Our next one is a specific one. Talking about actually getting to an endpoint. And they say, if a ROD specifies a groundwater cleanup endpoint as two samples below a cleanup level, do we have recourse using this new guidance and tool to refute this, quote, two-and-done mentality? These are typically based on annual groundwater samples.
You want to take that?
The way our recommended approach in the tool is geared is based on our current best thought with regards to the performance of the remediation systems. If there is a ROD and maybe an older ROD that that was written in that way, that's not really our current thinking. So I'm not exactly sure how we would evaluate addressing that two-and-done mentality. It's not the way a lot of EPA guidances for groundwater remediation are factored, or the Unified Statistics guidance from 2009.
Not the recommended standard practice.
Yeah, and this is Kate Groupie. EPA's mission in the Superfund program is to select and implement remedies that are protective of human health and the environment. We evaluate that metric when we delete sites from the MPL. Therefore, if a ROD that was written in the past has a two-and-done mentality that EPA does not think would be sufficient to support that we have met adequately from a data, I guess, perspective that cleanup levels and remedial action objectives have been met, it would be prudent for all stakeholders to evaluate that decision and perhaps modify it before they get to the end of the line. You then run into an issue where there's not data that's defensible and supportable for us to make the determination that it would be off the MPL. So even if a record of decision has that, I would defer to our another group in our office that does records of decision, but I would strongly encourage that that decision be revisited in some way, shape, or form.
But that's right. If you do a remedy completion strategy, you can pick up on that, and you can identify that as an issue and work with the stakeholders and site team to figure out a way to deal with that before you get to the end of the day. And you have some population thinking you're on one path to getting done and others thinking something else. So it's a good example.
Okay. We just had one participant, just for clarification, they're not familiar with this concept of two and done. Can you explain what that term means?
There's some records of decision, and we don't generally write records of decision now that are prescriptive on the number of samples that are required to demonstrate meeting a particular cleanup level or remedial action objective, but I know some older RODs that were done in the infancy of our program have alluded to that type of clear metric for being done. So the two and done would be if you at a monitoring well have two sampling events that are below the cleanup level, then you have met the cleanup level. So it's defining attainment in the record of decision by two sampling events.
Again, that's not the recommended approach.
Okay.
Okay.
We have another question that asks, how long should attainment monitoring last?
So the period of time to which one does attainment monitoring is based on site-specific aquifer conditions and parameters. We're going to go into that more in our webinar next Wednesday as to some of our recommendations. We do speak in the recommended approach about two lines of evidence that are needed to really demonstrate attainment. One, that the cleanup level has been met, which is a statistical determination using an upper confidence limit on the mean. And second, to look at the trend to see if it's statistically significant, increasing, decreasing, or there's no slope. When doing those two lines of evidence and applying statistics, we generally recommend 8 data points. Now, frequency of your collection of your data points will dictate the time period in which you're doing that evaluation. So for fast-moving aquifers, it may be more prudent to take samples maybe quarterly. Slower-moving aquifers, you may need to evaluate a longer sampling frequency. So there's no hard and fast time period. It's more site-specific conditions define and inform that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, looks like we've got about 15 or 16 minutes left in our time slot for today. We do have a few more questions, but why don't we carry on with the slides and we'll take another break at the end.
Great, that sounds good. Thank you, Jean. Okay, let's see, trying to get to the next slide. Going to the next slide. Jean, can you help me get to the next slide? It doesn't seem to be going.
Yeah, you might need to click the arrow on the screen. I can click it for you for now.
Yeah, the arrow's disappeared there.
Click on that green arrow.
Okay, well, she's got another next one. Okay, so we said we talked just a little bit about technical and practicability waivers. So in some circumstances, as we mentioned earlier, sometimes maybe remedy operation, progress, or attainment evaluations may indicate that the current remedy may not achieve the applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, or ARARs, as defined in a record of decision or Superfund cleanup plan. In such circumstances, it may be appropriate to consider an ARR waiver. The CERCLA law, CERCLA, the Superfund law, does allow for limited ARR waivers. And the technical impracticability or TI waiver is one of six possible waivers defined under the CERCLA. And it may be appropriate when compliance is, quote unquote, technically impracticable from an engineering perspective. But it's important to note that even when an ARR is waived, and an ARR may be, for example, like the MCL or for a site, the ARR is waived, the remedy must be protective of human health and the environment.
It's still not going forward.
Try it now.
I mean, the little things aren't there.
Gene, the arrows, the little gray arrows that I can use are disappeared in my arrows.
Okay, I'll just click for you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
No problem.
Okay, here we go. We're good. Okay, so more than 100 TI waivers have been granted to date. So a lot of these are for groundwater, but some are also for surface water. And before a TI waiver is granted, typically there's been source control or containment has been conducted, and often multiple remedial technologies have been applied at a site. TI waivers are typically based on multiple lines of evidence, and common factors may include, for example, like the presence of an apple or other contaminants that are particularly difficult to remediate due to maybe low solubility, free phase, or entrapped residual contamination. There can also be complex geology or hydrogeology, such as, for example, as fractured bedrock. You may have karst terrain, heterogeneous soils. And typically, there's a time frame can be an issue as well, with more than 90% of the TI waivers having sites estimating time frames for remediation of more than 100 years. Okay, next slide, please, Jean. Thank you. Okay, in summary, EPA has identified the need for additional guidance, moved forward on putting that guidance together with the suite of groundwater guidance that we've just been discussing. The Superfund is striving to help focus resources on the information and decisions needed to effectively complete groundwater remedies. These are a large part of the program and definitely cost a lot of resources. The new Superfund groundwater guidance documents help provide a strategy for a stepwise planning and decision-making to help complete groundwater remedies in a cost-effective and timely fashion. They also provide an approach for evaluating completion of groundwater restoration actions. Okay, next slide, please, Jean. Okay, so here are a few resources where you can get the guidance documents that we talked about. The first web address is a gateway to a wealth of groundwater guidance that we have. And the Superfund Remedies report that I talked about can be achieved through reached through the second link. And at the bottom, there's a lot of information about TI waivers. Folks are typically pretty interested in that. And I know Gene did provide these as part of one of the pods for this webinar, but they are also available here. Next slide, then, please. So I just invite people, once again, to participate in the second of our two webinars about the groundwater guidance. And this one will be about evaluating completion of groundwater restoration actions. This will be happening next Wednesday, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern time. And this will help with understanding how groundwater data and site-specific conditions can be evaluated. We'll include a on-screen demo of the groundwater stats tool. So there's the link to register for that one. So, and next one, there we go, contacts for additional information, three of us, and then any questions that people might have. I guess I really appreciate people participating and encourage folks to participate next week as well. Appreciate the interest.
Okay, so I'll just remind people you can continue to submit your comments and questions in the Q&A window in the lower right corner. We'll go ahead and start walking through some of the questions that were previously submitted that we haven't read out loud, and then again, we'll use whatever time we have left to go through any other outstanding new questions that may have been submitted. We did have one question going back about groundwater data, and I don't know if we can answer this one, but the participant wants to know, can you assume that groundwater data is normally distributed?
I'm sorry, you kind of cut out there at the end, Jean.
Sir, the participant would like to know, can one assume that groundwater data is normally distributed?
Dave, why don't you take that?
You don't have to. In a lot of cases, groundwater data will not be normally distributed. But when doing the evaluation, especially with our tool and other tools that are available, are publicly available, a decision will be made based on the evaluation within the tool as to whether it's appropriate to use a parametric or non-parametric evaluation of that data.
So tag in next week, and there'll be lots more on that.
Okay. One of our participants has a comment and question on the statistical tool that you discussed. They say that the statistical tool is focused on well-by-well analysis. They ask, is the evaluation of the plume holistically, for example, the combination of wells allowed? And if so, what statistical tools are recommended for that approach?
We in Superfund recommend that wells are analyzed separately. If there's multiple screening intervals, we also recommend that those are analyzed separately within a well. The determinations that one makes at each monitoring well should be evaluated in conjunction with the conceptual site model to make a call on the plume. There's no statistical tool that we recommend for evaluating well-specific conclusions or aggregating them. We actually discourage aggregation of data between wells for purposes of completion.
Okay. We did have a question about sampling events and the attainment phase. This participant wanted to know, how many sampling events would you recommend in the attainment phase if all of your COCs are below MCL?
Again, we're going to get into this more next week. For performing the two statistics that I referenced in a previous question, to provide some statistical confidence, we recommend using 8. Our tool does not function unless you have a minimum of 4 data points. So one can run both statistics with 4 data points. The issue with using anything really less than 4, you don't have any statistical confidence really, but we generally recommend 8 to sort of provide enough statistical confidence to support your decision, I guess would be the way to state it. But we're gonna talk about that more next week.
Okay. We do have a comment about TIs. And this participant says that since TI is based on current engineering capabilities, are there provisions in the policies for revisiting TI decisions based on future advances in technology? So perhaps the TI was one way this year, but 10 years from now, we've got completely different technologies. Would that TI no longer be valid because of the advances in technology?
Currently, in the policy that we put out right now, we do not address the issue of future technological advances. Even in the 1993 TI guidance, it does acknowledge if there are advances, the responsible parties may come back to the EPA and ask for the ability to go ahead and implement them. And if those technologies can actually restore groundwater at that point, they would get out from under the TI waiver and get the UUUE designation.
Okay. We have had a few more sort of programmatic statistical questions, people wanting to know how many NPL sites there are, how many reach completion, how many ROD amendments do we do per year. I think those go a bit beyond the scope of what you guys addressed in today's session, but is generally, if people have sort of Superfund database questions, Is there a website or a place they can go to access those types of sort of programmatic level statistics in terms of Superfund sites in the NPL?
Yeah, there are some statistics on the web page. Unfortunately, there's they're doing a database transition now, so some of the data that's available on the EPA web page is kind of locked from November 2013. That's being updated. I mean, if someone has a specific question, they can call one of us and we can try to get the answer for it. But it's that's kind of where things are on that.
Yeah, they could email any of us. We can funnel it somewhere.
Yeah, you'd be happy to help with that.
Okay, and a
beginning
reminder,
in January, supposedly it's supposed to be accurate on the web.
Okay, and their contact information for the presenters, it's in the slide deck. We also have it posted on that seminar homepage, and we'll remind you how to get to that information before we close out today.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
We have a few other questions, and these talk about some just general problems from other stakeholders' perspectives. I don't know if you can comment, but one general concept that was brought up by one participant was that, they're running into problems actually achieving completion because they have cleanup standards that have been set into place which are below MCLs, and they feel those are based on out-of-date risk assessment information. And they want to know what exactly is the process that they have to try to address that type of an issue. Is there a way to get standards updated or to have those cleanup levels adjusted based off of new risk information?
I would defer to the region, the region's record of decision process and risk assessment process. That's a site-specific question that we can't generally discuss, but any updates to cleanup levels would happen in a record of decision process. So
yeah,
that's sort of outside the scope of this.
And then we also have some sort of general questions that are coming in where on a state-by-state basis, their state may not have certain cleanup levels or have standards. What would you recommend participants do if something doesn't exist for their specific state? Are there federal standards that should be applying? Should they be looking at other states and using those levels? What should they do when there's no state cleanup levels for them?
The CERCLA and the NCC outline how one establishes cleanup levels for beneficial use. ARARs and applicable, relevant, and appropriate requirements generally for drinking water aquifers are based on federal or state maximum concentration limits, or MCLs. In the event that one does not have an MCL, one generally uses a risk-based number. So that, again, is site-specific and dependent on the parameters of the risk assessment and the contaminant.
Just to add one thing to clarify, this strategy and the recommended approach in the tool doesn't change how we approach things. This is a responsive type activity where levels are set and the recommended approach and the tool help you determine if you have or have not met whatever cleanup levels have been designated, but not to designate new levels.
Yeah. So all the existing guides for that still is in play, still is applicable.
Okay. Well, I don't see any more specific questions here on the topic that you guys presented. So I guess in the last 2 minutes that we have before we walk through final reminders, again, indicating how they can access the slides, provide feedback, et cetera, I just want to turn it back to Anne and Kate and Dave and see if there are any closing thoughts you'd like to leave the audience with.
No, I really appreciate folks tagging in. I appreciate taking time out of your day to participate in the call and pose the questions. A lot of good questions came in. And I encourage people to look at the web page and look at the documents there and participate in the webinar next week. Thanks again.
Okay, well, with that, let me go ahead and walk through just a few final reminder items for participants. We did have just over 280 individuals joined us from all over the country today for today's live broadcast. I want to echo the thanks from our presenters to all of you who were able to join us for the live broadcast. I also want to thank our three instructors who took time out of their day to present today's topic. We do often get requests through CLUIN for training records. I just want to remind participants, if you do attend CLUIN Internet seminars, we do have a tool that you can use online. If you enter your email address on this webpage, it will automatically send an email to the address that you enter in there with a table listing all of the webinars that you've attended or checked in live. We're working to include archived webinars in that table, but for now we can at least generate an email with those that you've attended in person for the live delivery. If you're interested in a copy of the presentation materials, you'll find those listed on the resources or links page, as well as a number of the websites that were highlighted in today's presentation. Those are also active in the webinar under related URLs, so that box on the middle right, you can click on any one of the links, press the Browse To button, and open up those sites locally. If you happen to be watching the recorded version of today's webinar, those links will still function under related URLs. You can still click and open up those pages through the archived version. I will ask you to take just a moment or two and fill out a short online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session, both the content that was presented as well as our mechanism for delivery. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can hop on and fill out their own feedback form, and that link will be active from this point forward. So if you happen to be watching the recorded version, you can still provide feedback based off of that replay. Again, we do often get requests for CEUs and PDHs. We don't necessarily issue those for each of our webinars. However, if you fill out that online feedback form, there is a box you can check circled in red here. As long as your contact information is entered correctly and you check that box, we can generate an automated email which will verify you shared feedback after the live delivery. Many of our participants are able to earn credit for CEUs or PDHs with that automated email and a copy of the slides or the registration email received when they signed up. If you need any additional help documenting your participation or accessing other materials, you can email me directly at balance.gene@epa.gov. As mentioned, you'll find our instructor's contact information posted on the seminar homepage as well for follow-on questions. Lastly, we did record today's session. You will automatically receive an email to replay today's session. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks, and you'll be welcome to forward that email on to anyone else you think will find it to be a valuable expenditure of their time. As mentioned, we'll be carrying on with this topic next week on November 12th, so hopefully we'll see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN webinar. This is the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.